Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs.
Hi, welcome back to Your Family Dog. I'm Julie Fudge Smith, and I'm here with the incomparable Tina Spring. And we were talking today about topics for Your Family Dog, and I had been thinking about one. My husband is a law professor, and he teaches a wide variety of things from civil procedure to election law to jurisprudence to law and legislation, and I think he's going to try and teach con law next year. Anyway, he teaches all these, administrative law, that's a big one for him. But every once in a while, well, basically like once a year, especially in his civil procedure class, he will throw his notes for the day out the window and said, let's just talk about the law. And they talk about the philosophy of law, and they talk about justice and mercy and, you know, why it is you want to be a lawyer, and just really dig into the philosophy of law and the ethics of law. And some of the nitty-gritty stuff that these kids actually come to law school to take a look at, but they're so busy learning about civil procedure and torts that you don't have time to dig into the whys and wherefores of law. So I got to thinking about that, and I thought, you know, Tina and I, if it's probably patently obvious in our 2 years we've been recording, or 4 years, or however long it is you and I have been recording together, how we feel about animals and what our basic philosophy is. But we've never actually had an episode where we talked about why it is we do what we do, and what are the things that brought us to doing what we do, and what sustains us. And so we thought we would give some time to just talking about dogs and dog training and the philosophy and perhaps even theology of why we do what we do. And so with that, I'm going to just say one more thing, in maybe two, but at least one more thing. And that is, I have a couple of blogs that we will link to in the show notes on the origin of dog, and that, and about why dogs are dogs and dogs are not wolves. Because I think part of that goes to why it is Tina and I do what we do. Because as I told her in the beginning, I said, you know, loved my horses, loved the gerbils, love the hamster, not the same relationship that I have with my dog. I'm not inviting the gerbils to sleep on the end of the bed. And not that they would, because they're usually up anyway, but it's not the same relationship. And so part of what I think we do, why we do, is because of who dogs are. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tina to talk a little bit about why it is she does what she does so, so, so very, very well.
Oh, well, thank you for the compliment. I don't know that I've earned all that. So my why is multifold. I think that the easy answer is that dogs saved me, and I owe them, right? They saved me when I was younger from... They were a really safe place for my heart, and for me to land at a time when there weren't many other things that did that. And so I feel like I owe them, right? I'm also clear that relationship between a girl or a boy and their dog can truly be an avenue to a better life for both. And being a part of that is pretty fantastic. Now, that being said, I didn't start out with super kind, sweet methods, right? I started out with how pretty much all dogs were trained in the 70s and 80s, where it was pretty compulsion-based. And I used those methods kindly, right? It was never with the intent of hurting a dog, but used those methods because that's what I knew, until I had the dog that if you use those methods, you were going to get hurt. right? And that it was obviously too heavy-handed for that individual dog, who, by the way, was not a dog who had big feelings about anything. He was a really nice, stable dog. But if you use these more aversive methods, he escalated exponentially. And so I had to learn another way. And so I went back to the drawing board and decided I needed to learn more. So all of this was before I was a, you know, quote unquote, professional dog trainer. And so as I learned better methods, I was able, I learned that there was a lot more flexibility in behavior than I had been led to believe, and that there was much more available in a relationship with our animals than just telling them what to do all the time. That they had a whole portion, a whole vector of life and emotionality that, while I might have had a whisper that I recognized, I learned a lot more. So the short answer is, my journey with dogs has been a long and pretty magical one, and sometimes sad, right? It's a sad journey too. You were talking about Dominion and how that book changed your relationship with animals and how you thought about your stewardship of them. And do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. First of all, I wanted to say thank you for saying what you said, because I agree with you 100%. There's, once you've had this sort of a relationship with a dog, an intimate relationship, I mean, just there's, it is fundamentally changing. It's also fundamentally grounding. You know, I have found that my relationships with my dogs above and beyond just having fun together, they ground me. And when I read the book Dominion by Matthew Scully, which I will also link to in the show notes, it's a really beautiful book. And the subtitle is The Power of Man, The Suffering of Animals, and The Call to Mercy. And he talks about what does dominion mean? In Genesis, we are given stewardship of dominion over the earth. But what does that mean? It doesn't mean that we have complete and utter control and can do with the environment and with the creatures in it anything that we want. What it means more is stewardship. That we are given dominion, meaning we are given the responsibility to take care of that which God has given to us out of his love. And so therefore, we have a duty and obligation to respond to that with love and with care, and to avoid the suffering of animals, because our power is not in being able to control everything and causing, you know, undue suffering or use things in the way we think is whatever, you know, we want to. But indeed, our power and our grace and the better angels of who we are come when we respond to the environment and to those in our care who have no other voice, compassion, understanding, and respect. And love. So we love back in the same way that God has given us, in his love, this world to live in. And one of the things that I started thinking about with Dominion, and he talks about, you know, and this goes a little bit farther than just my relationship and dog training, but it did fundamentally call to me and say, how is it that I want to train? And I started out as with choke chains and with choke chains, quickly turned to positive reinforcement training and found the difference in Molly, who was our really difficult dog to begin with. But Dominion, if nothing else, cemented in me the absolute positive resolve to be positive in my interactions with animals and hopefully with people. I fail with people a lot more than I fail with animals, but I fail nonetheless, but it still gives me the resolve to stand up and try again because I have now grounded what I want to do, who I want to be, how I want my relationship to be with animals is grounded in caring and respecting their fundamental dignity. And the more I respect their fundamental dignity, the more I elevate the dignity of humanity too. When we allow ourselves to be corrupted or corroded, or we fall into unnecessary cruelty, not only are we being cruel to those who receive it, but we are diminishing ourselves as humans. We're diminishing our capacities to be everything that we are called to be. And so I try really hard to apply the idea of loving dominion to those animals that I work with. It has also helped me, and this may sound incongruous, but it's really not. It has also helped me to create appropriate priorities within my training. If you ask me, I love dogs. And I will care for them with compassion, the best of my ability, but humans come first. If I'm looking at a family unit, if I get mixed up and I say, well, you know, I need to do what's best for the dog, I will mess up completely. I have to have a priority or a hierarchy of being in order to be effective and to actually care the most effectively for the animals that people are asking me to work with. And when I make people the top priority, then inevitably I do the right thing by the dog as well. So dominion has also helped me to understand what my priorities ought to be and how to respond to those priorities with as much compassion and charity and justice that I can. There you go, Tina.
So I'm going to lighten it up a little, maybe a little. So for me, that... So I was raised as a child with methods that were more aversive and raised my daughter with methods that were more positive, but were not permissive. Right? I do think that the positive reinforcement based trainers, which by the way, I'm gonna grab this particular bull by the horns. There is no way that anyone can train any dog all positively. They are going to get frustrated. They are going to have to understand that there are boundaries and some things they're not allowed to do. Right. But we don't have to do that in a mean way. So I think often trainers kind of get on their little high horse about different methods. And I think that those of us who consider ourselves LIMA trainers, so least invasive, minimally aversive, are probably the clearest of the bunch. Because I'll tell you just going to dog shows. I see a lot of trainers who in their professional life will say, well, I'm an all positive dog trainer. And they'll scream that from the top of the mountain all day long and then watch them be incredibly unkind to their own dog in private. Right. So they're saying, like, I stand for this whole group of methodologies. But when it comes to my dog, I get frustrated and I act out in this in totally different way. I think partially because of how I was parented, and a lot of that parenting was very emotionally based, right? Like how the parent felt emotionally fed into what the consequence for the learner was going to be. I really try to separate that. Whether it's with my child or my grandkids, or whether it's with my dogs or my customers, that I'm trying to approach it from a little bit more clinical lens. I'm still going to talk about all the love and the cuddles, right? Like that, that's all important too. But I don't want to change how I'm interacting with an animal because I'm angry at it or because I'm frustrated because it's not going the way I want it to go. Instead, I view it as that it's just teaching and that needs to be done kindly and gently. But also I have to keep them safe. So that means that they can't have unlimited, unfettered freedom and happiness at all times. A long time ago, I said, you know, if my child and my dog aren't at least a little bit frustrated with me every day, I'm probably not doing my job very well. And I think it's easy for trainers to set families up to fail by creating this view that we all should have infinite grace for inappropriate behavior at all times, right? We should all just go through the world as a fairy godmother, giggling at inappropriate stuff and not having it impact us. And that's just unrealistic and unfair. It really, I will tell you, some of the least happy dogs I have ever met are dogs who don't understand what the rules are because it's never been explained to them in a way that made sense to them. And I would
say
it's true for kids, right? I want to know that when a new driver gets on the road in Athens, Georgia, that they understand that they drive in the right-hand lane. I don't want them in the left-hand lane. I'll be in that lane because that's my right-hand lane. So kind of like in the words of Frost, good fences make good neighbors, good boundaries make for happy families because we can rely on an overall system of structure that keeps everyone safe and reasonably happy within those boundaries.
Yes, I agree. I think setting reasonable boundaries is incredibly important. I think it's incredibly important for adults to set boundaries with other adults. I mean, I think boundaries are an integral part of, I mean, in some ways, that's why I think that's what the whole idea behind like etiquette and manners. I think when we have good manners, it's partly there to make somebody else more comfortable in our presence, but it's also there to allow us to know how to interact, which is a way of setting boundaries, of saying, okay, this is the appropriate way to interact with one another. That's why we have manners, because that sets up reasonable boundaries with each other. So it's the same kind of thing with our dogs. I want my dogs to be well-mannered, because that means that they understand the boundaries within which how they were supposed to be acting. And I will tell you, I fail, daily. I'm trying to do things right with my dogs. Like this morning, Clementine, I don't know how she opened it up, but she got into the trash at 4 a.m. I was not quiet about that. I'm like, Clementine, I woke up to hear something being shredded. And I'm like, Clementine, what are you doing? I don't know how she opened the door to the trash, but she did. I left it ajar by accident. But anyway, Clementine seems to have forgiven me for my outburst this morning, but it was 4 a.m. and I was rudely awakened by shredding garbage.
Right. Like, I don't know a mom who enjoys when the whole family has a stomach virus. We none of us have infinite grace, right? And I have to say, like, all of this stuff kind of does trickle down too, right? Like, I think about myself, like, I see a lot of families who expect the family dog to have more grace and more tolerance of inappropriate behavior from children than they would from another human or from themselves. Right. Like, I'm sorry, but every single mama, unless she isn't really a mama yet, has lost her nut a time or two over something that you're like, really? We've talked about this before. Right. you know, not all moms come when called 100% of the time.
That's right. And, you know, it's so funny because I can't think of the number of times that I have said, we've talked about this. And I hear my daughter say, we've talked about this. It's kind of like, I think it comes when you give birth, it's been implanted in your brain somehow, the whole process of birthing that says, you know, or adopting, whatever it is that child comes into your life, somehow or another, there's this implantation of this, of the phrase, we've talked about this.
Right. Like I used to say to my daughter, are you new? Right. Like, Victor. You know the rule, right? Like, are you new? Like, you're new? Okay. Then I'll explain it again. Right. So if I think about how many times the average mom sings her or dad sings his ABCs before their child's nailing it on their own. Right. I mean, that's probably thousands of repetitions, maybe even more, right? And we don't keep track of it. We don't go, listen, this is the 18,927th time I have sung my ABCs. You should just have it by now. We just sing our ABCs, right? I kind of sing it literally the same way to my customers. Like, not every puppy is gonna figure out what you're trying to teach them the very first time. The vast majority of the time, they don't. Just like acquiring any new skill for me is going to be a hot mess first. And if I work at it, it gets better. The same thing is true with our puppies. And what I see is people do the opposite, right? They're super patient when the puppy is, you know, that first 10 days. And then that patience kind of goes out the window. And then I start hearing things like the dog is stubborn, or the dog won't listen. I was like, you do realize that, you know, Mitzi does not speak English. She's a dog, right? She didn't.
Right.
It amazes me how often we don't know what the rules of the household are for our own dogs before we start getting dogs and teaching them. And so if we don't know what the rules are, if the rules are variable all the time, and they're situational, how is the dog supposed to successfully navigate that? And honestly, I think becoming a parent made me a better dog trainer. And I think being a dog trainer made me a better parent because I have tools in parenting. I have tools in dog training that are not in line with my values and integrity. And so they are off limits, no matter how frustrated I get, no matter how angry I get, no matter how tired I am, no matter how bad how inappropriate the behavior, right? Those are just, they are in a no zone that I don't cross, right? I think with our dogs, it breaks my heart when I have a dog come to me that is obviously a very soft, fearful dog who was trained completely with shock collar.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Dogs just terrifying.
Right. And if it's not shock collars, which is, I think, the worst, but just even adversive methods. If you have a really soft individual and you use those adversive methods, you may ruin the dog for life. I had one person I knew, she didn't become a client, but we ran into each other a lot. We lived in the same neighborhood. She had a tiny, tiny Sheltie. I mean, just little bitty, like miniature Sheltie. And she took it to a trainer, and the dog, then the trainer was holding it. The dog turned around and didn't like the way she made it, and didn't bite, but kind of erred her. She hung the dog. And this is a 4-pound dog. And the dog was never the same, ever. It was such a traumatic experience for that little dog. And for the rest of its life, it was terrified of new people. You know, I worked with her a little bit, and we tried all different kinds of things and stuff, but it fundamentally change that dog.
Well, the same way that for any individual human, a correction given by someone, it doesn't mean hitting, right? Like, so this is the thing. Punishment is so individualized. It's so individualized. I have a really big personality. I'm aware of that. I also take a correction very well. You don't ever have to yell at me. You don't ever have to be ugly to me. You can softly and kindly say, like, hey, I need to talk to you about this, da da da. And I will also, I'm self-aware enough to tell you, like, yeah, that's not something about me. I'm going to change. Or that I'll say, oh my goodness. And even then I would say, like, okay, yeah, it's one of my character flaws. It just is what it is. And I'm terribly sorry that it bothered you. I'll do my best. But it's probably like, I am a fan of the cursey words. Like, I just am. And so while I endeavor not to use them on the podcast, I am a fan of the cursey words, and I'm not likely to give them up because, frankly, sometimes they're beautiful, flowery language that I enjoy, and it keeps my blood pressure down. So I don't need a big correction. I also know people that if you don't, like, use a bullhorn, they don't think you mean it, right? So I will tell you, the livestock guardian dogs, if you're heavy-handed with them, you will almost always ruin them. You will end up with an aggressive, nasty dog, right?
Absolutely. Because they are, they're so incredibly smart. They're very sensitive. They are so sensitive. And they have to be, because they are guarding a flock of individuals. They have to be aware of the individuals within their group. Did I ever tell you that we encountered a Great Pyrenees, working in the Pyrenees Mountains? And we were driving, and we realized we needed to stop and look at the map. So we backed into this little place on the road that was like a little divot. And we backed in, and suddenly I look in the rearview mirror, and rising up from the hill behind us was this Great Pyrenees, and he was staring at us, and he let out this big wolf, like, you're getting too close to my sheepies. And we moved as quickly as we could. But they are incredibly smart, incredibly sensitive, and just wonderful dogs. But you're right, you cannot be heavy-handed with them.
No.
You just can't.
Because that's how to get into a fight with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Because, and I will absolutely say to you, breed matters. It absolutely matters. Right.
It does.
A border collie biting at feet is different than a bulldog biting at feet.
Yes, I would agree.
Versus a golden retriever biting at feet. Like, those are all very different behaviors. In one, it's herding behavior. In one, it's predatory behavior. And in one, it's over-aroused behavior, right? If the dog's read the manual. So, you know, in toy breeds, I think going after feet is often a fear response. And I see lots of people wrestle with their Yorkie puppy with their feet in socks. And then, big surprise, they're tripping over their dog because it's trying to bite their feet as they walk by, right? So it's interesting. And I would say, I do listen to the dogs a little bit, a lot of it. I let dogs tell me what dogs think are a problem. Like, I have this sweet little puppy in puppy class right now whose play is a little over aroused for my taste. And so, and I really, really like the owner. I have a very good rapport with her family. And I said, hey, the next time you guys have like a busy weekend, can she come stay at the house? And I'm going to put her out with one of my dogs who's really good with puppies, to see what he thinks about it. Like, does he think it's a problem? Because I'll be able to tell based on his response whether he thinks this puppy is struggling with some over-arousal. And if he does, I'll just shoot video and make notes about what behaviors he's using as red lights and what behaviors he's using as green lights. So when the puppy does X, he stands completely still and doesn't play. But what behaviors does that puppy offer that make him go, yes, I'm willing to engage and play with you? Because he's really good at that stuff. So dogs, a stable dog will teach you a lot too.
Right. So I think that we've gone over some examples of some of the things that we've encountered as trainers and some of the things that we see in dogs. And I think that that ties into very intimately why we do what we do, because if we hadn't been invested in the idea of training and training with mercy and compassion and fairness and, you know, and wanting to help families have well-mannered dogs, we wouldn't have spent the time looking so carefully at what dogs are and what they do and how they communicate. And so one of the things that I think is important for people, if you're looking for a trainer, ask the trainer, you know, stuff like, well, what, how do you interpret this behavior? Or what do you think of this? Or have you seen a dog do this behavior before? And what do you think it means? Because the more somebody has actually sat and watched dogs and cared about dogs and learned about dogs, the more they're going to be robustly interested in providing for you the best experience possible. Hopefully. Yeah. I was thinking, like, one of the things is I love to, I watch the way dogs walk all the time. I'm always watching gaits because it can tell you so much about their health, right? So I'm always watching dogs' gaits. So what I find is my husband and I were out walking and I said, oh, that woman's got a hip problem. And he's like, how do you know? I said, because of her gait. And so I find myself looking at the gaits of all kinds of animals, horses, dogs, people. And it's funny because when I notice something like that in a dog, or I notice something like that in a person, and then I have a chance to encounter them, sometimes I find, oh, you're a little cranky. You might be in pain. I noticed your gait that, you know, you favor the left or the right. So I think that these kinds of things are really important, and they should be important to those who care deeply about providing robust, just, merciful training.
Right. So this morning at 10 a.m., I had two puppies in puppy class. One that is a veteran puppy. She's getting ready to move into adolescent puppy class. So she'll be leaving kindergarten and moving into middle school. And then a little Yorkie puppy that it's her first day of class, right? It's her first day of school. And the little Yorkie puppy urinated probably a teaspoon 4 times in the hour. And I said to the owner, that looks like a UTI to me. She needs to go to the vet. And she said, well, she went to the vet last week for vaccine. And so I explained, yes, I understand, but a veterinarian is not going to look for a urinary tract infection unless they know they need to look for a urinary tract infection. And so I said, you know, the only time that I would expect that that behavior would be normal, which it would be a much larger volume, is if it had been out outside and the puppy had romped around and played a bunch and drank a bunch of water and then came into class. But then we would be peeing small lakes, right? Not little itty bitty volume.
Now, could it also, I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Of course.
Could it also be an anxiety response that as things are going along, if it gets a little anxious, it pees a little bit?
So in each of the times when she urinated, no one had reached, like there was no, it wasn't in a response to anything observable. So it actually appeared that she was peeing when she was more relaxed. And so I asked, if it's a brand new puppy to me, I asked a bunch of questions about at home, is this happening too? And does it kind of ebb and flow? Like, does it change? And so, you know, hopefully she's taking her puppy to the vet today. The other puppy in class, I asked, like, she came in today super happy and fired up and wacky. And I'm pretty sure we're teething, right? That we're a little jacked up because we're teething, we're cutting teeth. And so that'll impact sleep quality. It also means she's moving into a new developmental phase where all sorts of things are going to be adjusting and changing because her body and her brain are starting to mature a little bit differently. So it gives me a really good opportunity to chat about all those things, right? So saying to that owner, so at the time I was eating my carrots and I offered the, you know, last little bite of the baby carrot a couple of times to the puppy. She was, I wish I had filmed it. It was adorable. She like first played with the little end cap of the baby carrot, like it was the world's tiniest orange ball. And it was super, super cute. She was like jumping on it like a kitten and then rolling on it and putting it in her mouth and spitting it at me and rolling it across the floor. But eventually she ate both of those little pieces of carrot. And so I said to her owner, you might try freezing some carrots and offering those to her as chew toys when she's in her crate, because that iced carrot, now, I mean, I wouldn't freeze it solid, but I would freeze it a little bit soft so that she can ice her little gums chewing on it. So, yeah, I mean, part of what somebody should be looking for in someone to partner in raising their dog, or it should be, in theory, someone who has a little bit more global view of the overall dog. So nutrition, development, sleep, my kingdom, for people to stop making their dogs so tired that they can't behave well. Like, I want to burn down the "a tired dog is a good dog" saying, because no, a tired dog is just an exhausted dog. It doesn't mean they're happy or good. It just means they're frustrated.
The other one that bothers me is, oh, look, he's not doing anything, so he's a good dog. No, no behavior is not the same as good behavior. So I'd like to throw out the tired dog is a good dog, because not all tired dogs are good dogs. Sometimes when you get overtired, you get overwired. The other one I really don't like is the, you know, people need to understand, and this is actually a phrase I like, no behavior is not the same as good behavior. And so I think that the other thing to pay attention to is, what kind of questions does your trainer ask? You know, and if for me, when somebody says, I said, well, you know, how is she with kids? Oh, she's fine. Fine is a big red flag for me. I don't want fine. I want great. And it's like, I don't want your dog just to survive. I want your dog to thrive.
So even I think within that though, right? Like, how many people think like, oh no, my dog's super happy to have my 11-year-old laying on him.
Right. And because maybe the dog is shutting down and it's not doing anything, that is not the same as enjoying the 11-year-old lying on you. So I think it's important for you to look for a trainer who understands about all levels of behavior, from what's normal doggy behavior, what's a lack of behavior mean in this situation, what's hyper behavior, what's aggressive behavior, what's my dog doing? Because if you start thinking that things like my 11-year-old lying on my dog because he doesn't do anything is okay, but your trainer may notice, for example, that the dog lying there is licking his lips. You know, his ears may be pressed back. Those are two strong signals to me that things are not going well.
I sometimes have said, okay, so if your partner or if your oldest child had that look on their face, what would you think they would be communicating? How do you think they're feeling?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Fortunately for dogs, a lot of the signaling, especially if they're not vocalizing growls, although frankly, I have growled at a child from time to time. I mean, we do. We give them the whale eye.
Yeah.
And we grumble at them. Like, would you knock it off? Right? That's a growl, y'all. Like, So does that mean that I should get yelled at because I was like, stop kicking my seat? Well, that's a growl, right? Like, let's not hold dogs to a higher standard than we have ourselves. Did it injure my child to say, stop kicking my seat? No, it didn't. And if it hurt their feeling, I don't really care. I don't really care. Stop kicking my seat.
Manners. It's once again, it's setting boundaries. Good manners set reasonable boundaries and expectations on each other. Yeah. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I was thinking about going back to Dominion when he talks about, you know, caring for the environment and being stewards. I just kept thinking it's kind of like stewardship towards everything. And part of stewardship is manners. Part of stewardship is being respectful to others and then expecting that respect in return.
And frankly, how to respond when you have an experience with another living thing that's maybe not being calm, gentle, and fair, right? So from Colleen, I still use calm, gentle, fair. The human has to be calm, gentle, and fair, and so does the dog, right? And I often think the instructor needs to be calm, gentle, and fair. The student also needs to be calm, gentle, and fair. But sometimes it's not reciprocated. And how you respond to that matters, right? So
it does, because if I don't respond correctly, I will tell you I'm in line for confession the next week.
And likely you're teaching that other individual how to treat
that it's okay. Right. That this is who I am. And it justifies their bad behavior. If you behave badly back to them, they're like, okay, well, obviously, you know, justified in my means of treating you if that's the way you're going to treat me.
And don't sandbag, right? Like, I don't know. I don't pull punches and I don't take cheap shots, right? If I'm frustrated with you, I'm going to cool off and then I'm going to try to logically have a conversation with you because I want to fix whatever it is and resolve it, right? I'm not going to wait 10 years and then one day lose my cool and email you a list of all the things about you that suck and that have bothered me or seemed unfair or unkind or whatever.
And I will verify the fact that Tina has not sent me that email.
No.
As much as she may have wanted to, she has not sent that email to me.
No, but so I use the 24-hour rule, right? If 24 hours later it's still bothering me, then we're probably going to have to talk about it at some point. It's profoundly unfair to wait, to let your dog training instructor call you Debbie for a 6-week class and then say, by the way, I don't like it when anyone calls me Debbie, and you never learned my name. Right? I prefer Deborah and you never care. Like, what are you talking about? Like, give a girl a heads up. Like, I don't want to call you a name that you don't like. Right? So it's the same thing. Like, surely we can mean what we say and do that gently and calmly and nicely. Like, hey, please don't. Like, so I'm a Yankee in the South. In the North, you basically only get ma'amed if you're being a jerk, right? Because where I grew up, if I'm being a jerk to someone, they're going to increase the amount of polite behavior that they're going to extend as a signal that I'm out of line. So I'm going to get ma'amed. In the South, I'm going to get ma'amed all the time, but it does create an emotional response, right? Like, I know my brain is a Yankee brain. It's not a Southerner brain. So to me, it doesn't feel polite. It feels like I'm in trouble.
I want to say, what did I do? What did I do?
Because they're trying to extend a beautiful, kind courtesy. And it doesn't mean the same thing culturally for me. So I just release them from the expectation and make them aware that sometimes that doesn't land exactly the way you'd expect. And we find an answer somewhere in between. They're going to occasionally ma'am me. I'm going to ask if I'm in trouble. But I'm also going to forgive them when they do ma'am me. Like, I'm not going to hold it against them. I'm going to know that from their cultural lens, they're being polite and courteous. So I know that they now are aware that that doesn't land exactly the same way for me, right? They're not wrong and neither am I. It's just different. Your dog is not using human rules, right? They're not, they don't have the same lens. So a dog who eliminates when you put them behind a gate and move out of sight may just not be fully house trained. They may have an adrenaline dump from the stress of being separated from you without information, which speeds their metabolism and results in them urinating. They may be urinating where a dog who resided in the household before you bought the house eliminated. They may have a urinary tract infection. They may be able to answer that question a whole bunch of other ways. I'll think of at 3 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep. The dog I'm specifically talking about, my guess is he's not house trained. He's just not house trained. So he doesn't realize that he's not supposed to do that, even though he's three. So we talked about how to help that dog be more successful and how to run down some of those questions to have a better understanding of why the behavior might be happening and how, but we also, I'm not also going to give the owner some really good advice about different ways, different strategies to handle the situation so that we're separating out and triaging what the causation might be, but also hopefully starting to stop the behavior.
Right.
Was I confusing?
No, you weren't confusing. And I think those are all really good things to think about when you're thinking in terms of what's going on with my dog, to take that step backwards and not just immediately assume that he's urinating out of spite, that that there could be a more complicated reason. There could be a very simple reason, but not to automatically assume that there's something vindictive going on with your dog when he urinates when you're out of sight from him. The reason I said right was because I'm thinking that's really good information and a really good way to think about dogs. And this whole discussion started with us trying to talking about what is it that got us motivated into training? What is it is our philosophy behind training? And I think these are all really good examples of how it is that we view dogs, how it is we view people, and how we view our interactions with them, that they are supposed to be coming from us a thoughtful and kind way to view the situation, to take a step back and say, okay, I understand your frustration, or I understand that this is a problem, but let's see if we can't take a look at this in a way that is helpful for you, for the dog, for your family, for us. And it's all a reflection of the underlying philosophy and the underlying love that we have for these incredible creatures, both human and canine. And so while it seems as though we sort of veered off, in some ways it's not. These are petals. It's not just looking at the center of the rose. These are the petals that are the expression of the beauty of what it is that we do, and an expression of how it is we want to serve you, so that we are trying to look at this in a way in which we can set everyone up to be successful.
Well, I'll give you a funny story. So I have a dear friend who had a German Shepherd girl. Like, Rebecca had done a phenomenal job training Samantha. So she came in and told me this story one day. So she took Samantha in the car somewhere and goes to get her out. And when she opens the car door, Samantha like all but tackles her trying to get out of the car. And so she, like, this is an adult dog. Like, she's never been allowed to do this. So Rebecca shoves her back in the car and is like, hey, knock it off. And she does that a couple of times. And then Samantha barfed all over her.
Oh, because she wanted to get out of the car because she wasn't feeling well and I needed to, yeah.
And so Rebecca felt really badly. She's like, so here I'm giving this dog a hard time about stop trying to bolt out of the car, you jerk. But a dog doesn't have a way to say, I'm going to toss my cookies. And if you don't get out of the way, it's going to be on you. Right? Like well, I have a dire need to get out of this vehicle.
But the one thing I will say is that dogs will do for you is they'll do the hug, you know, before they vomit, if you're lucky.
Sometimes. If you're lucky. In this case, that was not the case.
No, they didn't get the huggas. Yes.
They didn't get the warnings. So like, am I gonna sit down and, you know, do some major differential for every single behavior my dog offers? No. Right? Nor am I encouraging that. But I do think when we have a quote problem, that taking a little bit different view of it, rarely in growing up were my parents curious why their children exhibited specific behaviors. There were behaviors that I got into really big trouble about that I didn't deserve it. It was that they didn't understand the motivation and why the situation occurred. And maybe if they had had a little bit less stress and if they had slowed down, they probably would not have responded the way they did. I think most of us as parents looking back go, yeah, I could have handled that better, right? Because we're all just doing the best we can. And my experience is that often our dogs are doing the best they can too.
Yeah, I would agree. I remember one time with Emma. We were cooking in the kitchen and I left the room for a minute and I was coming back and she said, Mom, the oven is on fire. I was like, no, it's not. There's just a little bit of, you know, junk on the bottom of the oven that's, you know, smoking, that's burning off. She goes, no, Mom, the oven's on fire. I'm like, no, Em, I baked a pie and I know this is what. She goes, Mom. And I look and indeed there was a fire in the oven. And it was kind of like, sometimes we have to take the information given to us at face value. That and that kind of works with the dogs too. Is this it's that whole taking a step back and go, why would Emma tell me the oven is on fire if there's just a little bit of smoke, right? Why would my dog be doing that? Maybe there's something to this. So I think sometimes you have to take it at face value. When they give you information, you need to say, okay. What does this information mean? And then you can apply my favorite, Aristotle's principle of parsimony or Occam's razor. Other people call it that. But it's basically the idea, what's the simplest explanation to go with this? And the simplest explanation in the case of Emma was that, yes, there was actually a fire in the oven. So, you know, maybe the dog whining and crying by their door means they need to go out. They're not just giving you smack.
Well, so in the example of the dog I was just talking about, we have littermate syndrome going on. These people did not get the puppies as littermates. Previous household did. The female appears to be they're almost 4 years old. The female appears to be house trained. Like she'll go to the back door and look at the door and look at you and look at the door and look at you when she needs to go outside. The male never asks to go outside. And I said, well, he may not realize he's supposed to. Like he has a sister who, when she has to go potty, asks, and then you open the door and you take them out. So if she's not out with him to say like, hey, we need to go, he may not know that he needs to do that. Right. Like he may have just never learned it.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Even as a young puppy, you're going to take them both out together. So she learned it. He didn't. It doesn't mean he's dumb. He's not. It just means he didn't realize that that information was important. So
right. Well, what he learned was my signal to go out is my sister whining.
Right. And frankly, when we're talking about littermate syndrome, there's a little bit of like, okay, how many brain cells reside in each dog, right? So
it's kind of like there's one brain for two dogs.
So
what it feels
so
like.
A lot of times I explain it kind of like marriage, right? Or long-term partnerships. There are some things Christopher is responsible for by default, There are some things I'm responsible for by default. It's kind of just an agreement between Christopher and I together. You have almost a remarkably well-functioning system, but he doesn't need a ladder to change a light bulb. I do. So light bulb changing kind of falls to him. So if the light's out, I'm just going to say, hey, Christopher, the light's out in the bathroom. And he's gonna do that. It's less cumbersome for him to take care of it than me, right? So these two puppies, he learned when his light's out, his sister takes care of it. So when he's by himself, he doesn't. And how do you know if the barking he's doing because you left the room, it's not any different than the barking that right. he could potentially be doing that says, hey, I need to go outside. So I just talked to them that while we have his sister, because we are going to teach them to be separate from one another, that may be some of the work they want to do with him is to go back and re-house train and just start over and teach him. Instead of going, he's being spiteful, he's having a temper tantrum, he's being stubborn, like, he doesn't want to get yelled at about urine any more than you want to yell at him about urine in the house.
Right. I think the other thing to remember, too, is that just because he's 4 years old doesn't mean he can't learn. I mean, people tend to think that you know, once my dog has reached a certain age, you can't teach him anything. And then that's just not true either. The learning process may be a bit different. It may take a little bit longer if you're sort of reteaching something. But, you know, it's never too old to train your dog. And it's never too late, well, except maybe on their deathbed. But in general, you can teach an old dog new tricks. And you can teach a new dog old tricks. And you can change behaviors. But it does require some time, patience, and a huge dose of humor.
Extending grace is a big thing. I'll give you another funny story. So our laundry sorter has darks, mediums, and lights, right? So it's like, darks, mediums, and whites. That is not how Christopher. So when the seasons changed, all of a sudden, black socks were ending up in the mediums or in the whites. And I couldn't figure it out. I was like, what is he doing? Like, is he just a goofball? And so I asked him, why are there all these black socks in the whites? And he said, oh, because my brain says that that's the socks container.
Okay. Yeah. I wash socks and underwear together.
Because most of our whites are socks. Like, we have four dogs. He works on cars for a living. We don't wear white. Like, there's no white in our world. Like, it would all just be black or orange by the end of the day. So there's not a lot of whites. But his brain didn't assign whites. It assigned socks. Right. So there's an example. I could have spent the rest of our relationship being mad at him that he was intentionally screwing up the laundry. Or I could be like, hey, goofball, why is this happening? Right. And the same kind of thing happens with the dogs. It just does. It happens with the dogs, too. They make decisions because their understanding and our understanding is different, or our kids' understanding and my understanding is different,
right?
Or my friends' understanding and my understanding are different, or my customers' understanding and like what I thought I said and what my learner learned were two different things. So you just double back.
Yeah. When I remember with my kids, I learned really early on. My mother would always say to me, "Did you learn your lesson?" And I was always like, I'd always just say yes, because if you said no, then you got a lecture. But when I realized—
it would not make the lesson any clearer.
Right. Especially my father was really prone to lecture. My mother, not so much. My mother was more the silent treatment. My dad was more like the lecture. So if you learn your lesson, you just say yes, because even if you didn't know what the lesson
was— because that was the lesson you learned.
That's right.
Instead,
what I said to my daughters is when we would have a situation and we would be talking about it, then I would turn to them and I would ask them, so what did you learn? Or what lesson did you learn from all this? Because what I hoped that they learned was not necessarily what it is that they learned. So to ask them what it is that they learned was oftentimes a real eye-opener. for me because it wasn't necessarily what I was hoping they'd learn, but it gave me an insight into how they were thinking and a chance then to open the discussion and say, okay, well, I hadn't thought of it that way. The way I'd been thinking of it was this. And so I think sometimes that spread over a little bit into my dog training as well, was that I would look at the dog and then it would be, okay, so what is it we just learned here? You know, may not have been what I was trying to teach, but there could be something valuable here that we've learned that I need to know and you need to know. So I think with that, this wide-ranging discussion, I think still wraps up with the idea that if you're looking for a trainer, if you're looking for somebody to help you in caring for your dog's behavior and looking for training, ask some questions. Ask, you know, how is it that you view dogs? Why is it you do what you do? You know, how is it that you see, you know, give them a situation and say, how would you deal with the situation? How would you see this? Because I think it'll give you a real clear understanding. And hopefully this session has given you a little bit of a look into Tina and my brains and how it is that we look at dogs.
And also how we look at people. I want the benefit of the opportunity to talk about something that is frustrating you so that I can fix it, right? I want the relationship matters to me.
Yes.
Ideally, I would assume that about the people who are interacting with me, as well as my relationships with my dogs. The relationship matters to me more than whether or not the dog sits the exact moment I ask them to sit, right? Even in my relationship with other humans, I don't assume that Julie would never do this, but if Julie did something ugly to me, I'm not assuming that Julie is a jerk. Instead, I'm like, wow. I'm thinking to myself, she's having a really rough day today. Like, I wonder how I can love her better.
Right? See, you are a much nicer person than I am.
It's why when I had someone once say that this was an ex-training client who tried to say that I lacked empathy. She said it in an email. And when I read it out loud, Christopher and I both laughed out loud, right? It's this beautifully clarifying moment where I'm like, no, I don't. Like, am I the most empathetic person in the world? No, but I'm pretty darn nice. So if someone's hurling that kind of accusation at me, it's not actually always about me. It's sometimes about the other person, right?
Yes, I would agree.
But I will tell you, 10 years ago, if someone had said that to me, I would have been devastated because I kind of believed it was true.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that I was a bad person, and I'm not. I'm not a bad person. And your dog is probably not a bad dog. Your dog is just trying to get their needs met the same way you're trying to get your needs met.
Yeah. But no, I get that. It was, I've always been a fairly sensitive individual and especially sensitive to being told that I am inadequate or a jerk or whatever. So I think we all have our sensitive spots.
I think we're all jerks sometimes, but it's often completely unintentional.
True, true.
Right? True. We just didn't think about it.
That's right.
Anyway, and your dog probably didn't either. They don't lay in their bed at night thinking about how to make your life harder.
No, I really don't think they do.
Picking where they're going to pee in the house tomorrow. Like, they don't, they're not like that, generally.
No, generally they're not. I would
agree.
Except
for my own dogs. Just kidding. They don't.
I was teasing.
I mean, my dog's like hugs, but yours, I know yours doesn't. But mine do, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm sure Clementine thinks of ways in which she can be naughty. That's her whole modus operandi.
Well, she thinks it's funny. The motivation's different. So, she's just making sure that she clears all your blockages. So I would be curious if anyone in the audience wants to share their story about how their love affair with dogs started.
Yeah, that would be great to hear.
Right? Because I think that would be, I sometimes ask that question in my classes. But yeah, why dogs? Like, why do you have a dog? Why do you have a dog? And for some people, it might be, well, we've always had a dog. For some people, it might be, you know, my husband and my kids really like a dog. But yeah, give us some feedback about life with dogs.
And if you want to do that, probably the best way to get a hold of us is at yourfamilydogpodcast@icloud.com. That's yourfamilydogpodcast@icloud.com. And we look forward to hearing from you.
I can't help but wonder if you just accidentally didn't start a book club.
Ooh.
Because now I've downloaded Dominion, right? So I'll be listening to that while I'm driving and sleeping. We already have, I mean, I think the first book in the series would probably be
The Beastkeepers.
The book I'm listening to right now, which is The Beastkeepers. So yeah. If you think a book club would be a funny thing that you would enjoy from the Your Family Dog podcast, by all means, shout it out. We've got the tech. We can make it happen. We can totally do a book club via Zoom. That is something that can happen. So if that's something that would be interesting to you, please submit, yes, I'd be interested. And what your nomination for the first book would be if you were a member of a Your Family Dog podcast book club.
And I would recommend that it could be a book that is either in paperback or on Audible. So that
if I read, I fall asleep.
Right. So a book that would be on both. And the Beastkeepers, I know, is on both audiobooks. It's on Kindle.
I know. That's how I'm listening to it now.
And Audible. So anyway. So yeah. And I'm doing a book club on the book club, the Beastkeepers, in April. And I did one back in December. And it's been really fun. And I would love to do that again. So do let us know. And thank you so much for listening to Your Family Dog and for listening to Tina and I drone on and on and on. But we hope you enjoyed it, and we're looking forward to seeing you next time on Your Family Dog.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.